Good evening. My name is Peter Berg. I'm head of special collections in the Michigan State University Libraries, and I'd like to welcome you to another evening of the Michigan Writers Series. This is the beginning of our eighth season, and I couldn't believe it's eight, and I counted it up, and it's eight, but it doesn't seem possible, because we started in the winter of 1999 with Lev Raphael and Lauren Estelman. 99, 2000, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6... Yeah, six. So that's eight, right? It's our eighth year beginning, and I'm happy that you can be here for this reading tonight. Our guest reader is Steve Amick. Steve Amick has led an interesting life. He was born in Ann Arbor, Michigan in 1964, where he grew up and started writing and winning awards for his writing, including the National Scholastic Writing Contest Award for Humor at age 15. He left his home to go to St. Lawrence College in upstate New York, primarily because it was one of the few small liberal arts colleges to offer a major in writing. He received his bachelor's in 1986 and eventually ended up at George Mason University in Virginia, where he formed a band, Steve Amick and His Own Worst Enemies, and received an MFA in creative writing, studying with Richard Bosch and Susan Richards. Leaving graduate school in 1991, he taught writing for a while and then did some ad work in New York, where his work with The Village Voice, Snapple, Cartoon Network, and The Economist caught enough attention to merit various industry awards. Throughout the 1990s, Amick never stopped writing, and when his ad career allowed him to freelance, he moved back to Ann Arbor to devote more time to writing. His fiction has appeared on National Public Radio, in Playboy, The Southern Review, Tulane Review, and McSweeney's. He has had plays produced in Chicago, and his one-act play, Jazz Genius, A Symposium, won Best Playwright honors in 2001. In 2005, he published his first novel, The Lake, The River, and The Other Lake, which was the lead summer title for Pantheon, a division of Random House. It was selected by the American Booksellers Association as a May 2005 Book Sense pick and a 2006 Michigan Notable Book. Of the book, the LA Times wrote, "The last writer to celebrate the charms of rural Michigan with equal panache was probably Ernest Hemingway." Would you please join me in welcoming Steve Amick?
Thank you. I want to say right off the bat, even though I'm a Michigan writer and all that, and this climate, that this is fiction. And none of this is true. This book takes place in the summer of 2001 in a town that sort of hugs Lake Michigan, somewhere around here, with an inland lake. And it's one of these towns that is dependent on the summer economy, the influx of tourism and that sort of thing, as well as agriculture. So in the summer of 2001, a lot of things are changing for a lot of people there. And I'm going to try to read a little bit. There's about 10 major characters in this book, so it's just going to give you a little sense of it. I don't need to set this up because it's the first time we see this guy, Roger Drinkwater. And I always have to read this some part of Roger Drinkwater because he's seems to be everybody's favorite character in the book. There was a heavenly time, a sliver-thin window of peace that Roger Drinkwater cherished every year on Minnegeesis. Those early days when the water warmed just enough for him to bear, but all others steered clear, and he could swim in peace and hear nothing but the water and his breath and the birds and the distant road, the way it had once been on this lake. It was a time before jet skis, before the idiot boys on their idiot toys, as he thought of them in the little sing-song chant that drummed in his head the rest of each summer. One misty pre-dawn in late May, he got his first indication that the lake was now warm enough for at least a few intrepid others. Kids, of course, tended to brave the water sooner than their finicky parents, and the evidence he found was something that obviously came from a child. It was floating, half-submerged, at the end of his dock, and he bumped his head against it on the return lap of his morning swim, an underwater toy in the shape of a flattened megaphone, purple plastic with a green mouthpiece. If it hadn't had a brand name, Subspeaker, stamped on the side, he might not have known what it was for. He stood there in the water, examining it, disgusted, Plastic toys lost in the lake were essentially just pollution. Still, he wondered how well it worked. Glancing around first to make sure he was alone, he knelt to the waterline and put the mouthpiece to his lips. What came out was Chief Joseph Wonsong's famous words to Congress, "Niman na dendom gaji benadkum gazik." The water was so still, the sound waves would carry as if across a drumhead. "It's funnier," he decided, "if no one can see me." And so he dropped lower in the water, the toy just nosing above the waterline, and he repeated the phrase, making it more guttural and ominous and spooky. He imagined some dumb cluck on the other side, those rich weekend warriors with the matching hot pink jet skis and that pontoon boat, looking out and shuddering, unable to spot him, unable to understand the words, just knowing that the words were ancient, foreboding, and they would feel very, very uneasy. It was hard to do it without snickering. Roger Drinkwater was actually only 7/8 Indian, Ojibwe or Chippewa, or Anishinaabe, if you wanted to get precious about it, which he never did, of the Ojanamazibi band. The little bit left over was actually Polish, his mom's grandmother having come up as a young girl from Hamtramck outside Detroit back in 1914. She thought she would be spending just the one summer out at Cliffhead, the place people now called the Bootleggers, working as a nanny for the Fifles, the family of the man known at the time as the Rumbleseat King. She once told Roger she thought that at most she might learn to swim that summer. But much more than that happened. She got involved with Roger's great-grandfather, John Birchtree, a leather dark Indian boy who helped out in the Fifles stables, and she got in trouble and knew she could never go back home, and so they got married, both of them still teenagers. Even if she hadn't gotten in trouble, it would have been damaging enough just to have been briefly mixed up with an Indian boy. There were other Hamtramck girls in the household staff, and they would return with the Fifles, bringing sordid stories of the summer, and she would be ruined back home. Beyond ruined, she might be in actual danger there. So, though she never returned and never spoke to her family again, Grandma Oshka carried on the only tradition she knew, filling the many grandchildren and great-grandchildren that followed with Gawampki and Pierogi and tales of Smakvaveski, the dragon from the Waffle Castle in Krakow, and how a poor shoemaker killed the evil dragon with trickery and a river. But 7/8 was still pretty damn pure in 2001, and it was good enough for Roger to qualify for a dividend check with the area casino. $30,000 a year for doing nothing more than being a member of the regional band. He could make much more if he chose to actively participate in the actual operation, but he didn't. The casino was at least 2 hours away, and besides, having been to Nam, Roger figured he'd had enough gambling to last a lifetime or three. Besides, the casino money was only part of his income. There was the jerky business, the product sold as Shmatsna Gaskawag, at stores all over the county, and as far north as a frou-frou specialty food store his grade school buddy, Eric Revels, ran up in Petoskey, called Gourmet Gobbles. No one ever came in and asked for it by name. The combination of the Polish schmatzni, delicious, and the Ojibwe gaskawag, dried smoked meat, amounted to more than a mouthful for most fudgies, the weekend tourists from downstate. But they managed to figure out to ask for that local stuff, the, you know, that authentic stuff, the stuff in the baggies, and sales did not seem to suffer. During the summer, he periodically taught at the short-term dive school camps a mile out on Lake Michigan aboard a restored 19th-century schooner, and year-round, classes for the National Guard up in Grayling. During the school year, he was the high school swim coach. He got great results from those kids, producing 2 state champs in the past 10 years, and the school board kept trying to get him to coach more, especially water polo. But Roger said no way. First of all, he did not believe the water was a place for games. Even without the aid of an internal combustion engine or oversized floaties, as used in the more obvious sins of water skiing, jet skiing, parasailing, even water polo, just flouncing around, hitting balls, and carrying on, Roger deemed unacceptable. The water, he felt, was for meditation and sustenance and life, and in extreme times, battle, which was part of life. But his official bottom line for declining was the water polo headgear. "You shouldn't wear something on your head when you're in the water," he would say, "against my religion." If they looked at him blankly, he would shrug it off. "Hey, it's an original people thing. You wouldn't understand." The truth was, nothing with the word polo in it could possibly be tolerable. There was a song of his people that told, if you follow the river inland through the village, you come to the other lake. And lately, it seemed nearly everyone was coming to the other lake. Years ago, National Geographic had praised it for its clarity and beauty, and more recently, Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous had called it a local gem. To Roger Drinkwater's people, it was just Minnegisisigami, literally Berry Moon Lake. But what they had meant was Lake of the Moon when berries are picked, not because there were ever spectacular amounts of any kind of edible berries right around the lake, but just because that's how you say August in Ojibwe. Due to the shade of its densely wooded banks in the deep center of the lake, it never got very warm at all, and August was the only month the unaccustomed could manage getting in the water without a lot of silly shrieking. Maybe a more accurate translation would be, that lake you can really only stand during the moon in which berries are picked, where they are picked, meaning August, basically, but that wouldn't work on a map. I'm going to jump ahead a little with Roger. Roger goes on to almost get creamed by one of these jet skis early in the spring, and he complains to the sheriff. And this is the first summer that the sheriff has been replaced by a new guy, an outsider from Saginaw. And he's not following any of these local customs of certain curfews or anything. He's got a whole new plan. And he just tells Roger, why don't you try wearing a vividly colored bathing cap? Which Roger tries one time and ends up tearing it up and using it to sabotage the somebody's jet ski, shoving it in this Venturi nozzle. The other thing you should know is that this thing that he's saying is a quote from his hero, Chief Joseph Onesong, which is a fictional historical character in the book, who is invited to go to Congress in 1837, when Michigan is made a state, and he's asked to address Congress, and he just says in Ojibwe, you have all been a great disappointment. When are you leaving? So this is Roger's new battle cry this summer. The other thing you should know, and I think it's hinted at, is that Roger is also, before all this, he's an ex-Navy SEAL from Nam, as was mentioned. Specifically, specializing in underwater demolition. So more to come with that. There was another way Roger Drinkwater knew to make himself more visible to the enemy during his early morning swim on Minnegisis, an option that would spare him the indignity of the bathing cap. Besides, the bathing cap had also proven ineffectual even for purposes of sabotage, having managed to disable the jet ski for only a day. Though he sure did enjoy the entertainment for the better part of an afternoon, watching from his porch through field glasses, his feet up on the rail, and working his way through a whole pie from Von Busch Burgers. It was pre-season, made from frozen cherries, but still damn good. A treat, which is what he felt the occasion called for, as a pack of summer people stood around, knee-deep in the lake, trying to puzzle out why the thing wouldn't go, debating and theorizing, as if they were actually the kind of men who knew anything about anything other than which button to push to start the rider mower. But then the new sheriff stopped by, and then finally a truck from the marina in town. Probably they were the ones who found the bathing cap. In terms of being seen, he now had a better idea, war paint, much better than a stupid bathing cap. Natural paints were easy enough to make, sumac for red, goldenrod for yellow, pokeweed berries for a midnight blue. But he decided that for the lake, in the hours he went out, white would be best. Crushed limestone, the standard white, was something he didn't have, until he borrowed a handful from the pristine driveway at the new show place a few houses down and crushed it himself between two cast iron stove lids and the wheel of his truck, and then added water for a milky paste. The next step called for adding deer grease, which he had, but decided, come on, if it was going on his face, why not just substitute Vaseline? It would work about the same, and tradition was no reason he had to smell like entrails. When he smeared it all on, it felt like the black camo grease they had worn on operations in Nam. It was overcast the first morning he tried the war paint, the sky a wintry gray, with actual wisps of fog rolling low across the flat water. Perfect for spooking kids, but not so perfect for kids being out on the lake. But sure enough, midpoint in his return lap, he heard a jet ski start up. He judged this one as coming from over toward the big rental that was supposedly advertised in the New Yorker. Roger continued on underwater, nearing his own dock, and calculated that the kid was about 50 meters off and closing, about to loop across his path. It was shallow now, so he stood in one solid motion, turning to glare, zombie-eyed, at the kid. "Sure," he thought. "Now you can see me, goddammit." Startled, the kid made a sudden jagged correction and pitched back off the jet ski. Roger watched as the boy floundered and yelped, the water clearly too chilly for this fudgy. Finally, he climbed back on the bench seat of the jet ski and sat there staring, his motor idling. Roger raised both hands slowly and closed his eyes as if reciting some incantation. Peeking through slit lids, he saw the kid was shivering, mouth open, his eyes round as skipping stones, as if he was about to be flayed and dressed out like a buck. Roger gritted his teeth, clamped his jaw, kept his eyes squinted shut, trying to give the impression that he was concentrating on his hex, his voodoo spell, when actually he was just trying to keep from laughing. "Nima na dendom, gazi binadkum gizik," he chanted in deep, dead man tones. There was a whiny roar and the kid was gone. Roger swam around to the other side of the dock rather than wading through that area where the kid had just been. He was pretty sure he would be swimming through urine. So more happens with Roger, obviously. Besides the locals, there's of course the summer people, and I thought a good way to sort of give a little quick rendition of them was to read a little section from a 16-year-old named Mark Starkey, who's a teenager who comes up and they spend most of the summer up there. His dad's a lawyer from Birmingham. He's your typical disgruntled quasi-sociopath teenager. His parents have become a little bit concerned about his inability, apparently, to connect with people or have any sort of signs of empathy. For that reason, or for some reason, perhaps for social reasons, his dad gets him this job in this kind of cushy job, or it's sort of something that everybody sort of wants, as a pilot boy, an underboy, working on the river connecting the lake to Lake Michigan. It's a custom of this town that you pay the small fee to have your boat kind of squired into the inner lake. So he's literally getting on board other people's boats and sort of forced to deal with them, as well as with these local river guys who are kind of a joy in and of themselves. So Mark gives his little rendition of the summer people here and a little bit of the job. He feels that his dad is really more interested in just showing some of the locals that he's kind of a real local guy, even though he's a summer guy. As far as Mark could tell, there were three types of outsiders you could be if you didn't happen to get born and die in Winneshkeen, like the rest of these bumfucks his dad seemed to want to fit in with. There were the boat people who liked to just sit on their boats in the marina, watching the village as if waiting to get the word to invade. Except, why would they, he wondered, since these people already had everything, money and looks like you'd see in a movie. The boat people with kids hardly ever saw them because the kids had expensive bikes and rode them over every inch of the village, totally unsupervised. The grown-ups only left their boats for groceries, boat parts, booze, or maybe to purchase so-called artwork from the little shops, what Mark thought of as cheesy quack-quacks, crap like his dad had in his law office back home. Stuff that told other people you were simple folks. A lot of paintings of shabby little boats they would never actually set foot on. Then there were the fudgies, which were the full-on tourists, geeks who came for a weekend at a B&B or 1 week at a skeezy rental they saved up for 5 years. They paraded around like they were at Disney World and planned to make every minute count, damn it. They bought a lot of sweatshirts and antiques and polished Petoskey stones and homemade fudge, hence the name. But there were also your basic summer people, folks who interacted with the village a little more. These people owned a cottage or a summer home and stayed for most of the warmer months. They could be either self-employed people with flexible hours, or maybe distant relations or in-laws or descendants of those who built in earlier days when everything wasn't so expensive. Or the deed was still in the name of some local as their legal residence, so they could deduct all of their otherwise crazy-ass property taxes or some deal like that. The state's homestead law, his dad called it, usually in a grumbling way. Or they could be independently wealthy, or the wives and children of 9-to-5 millionaires who were meanwhile stuck downstate, still slaving away all summer. or maybe retirees with a winter home in Florida. Summer people did their own upkeep and maintenance and had a lot of projects around the house. Puttering, his dad called it. They got their own wells running in the spring and put out their own rafts and docks. They made a big show of going in to check their rarely used mailboxes at the post office, calling people by name, signing up for library cards. Some even used the laundromat. Basically, they tried real hard to blend in and usually got their feelings hurt when they found it wasn't that easy. Mark knew that last one was his category, or at least his family's category. Personally, he didn't relate to any of these people, outsiders or yokels, so probably you'd have to put him in his own little box. He didn't think there was any particular name for his box, but he preferred to think of it as a one-man box. His dad, in particular, really seemed to care about this blending in thing, though it seemed like it hadn't always been that way, not when they first bought the place on Lake Michigan. It started a few summers later, around the time they winterized and started remodeling and putting on the additions. As if coming up a few more weekends after Labor Day and that one Christmas the year his dad was into snowshoeing, as if that was going to make them all of a sudden locals. So they were sometimes up here after the leaves dropped or early enough to have to buy a sack of Morton's for the driveway. Big deal. They were still summer people, as far as he could tell. It wasn't like his dad had quit the firm back home in Birmingham, where he was still a full partner, specializing in class action law. There was a watercolor of their lake house hanging in his dad's inner office, smack on the wall right when you walked in, ready to be gawked at with a little gallery light on top to help you be impressed. And in case you didn't get the rustic thing, the frame was made of old barn wood or something with knots and wormholes like evidence in an insurance investigation. The point was supposed to be, look, I just work here, but this is not at all who I am, deep down. In reality, I'm this authentic up north Michigan guy, and if you can't reach me for some reason, this is where I am, up at the lake, hanging out with my salt of the earth fishing buddies and probably skinning a bear. It seemed ridiculous to Mark that with all these Opie Taylor types running around desperate for this stupid underboy gig, they'd go and give it to him, an outsider who didn't even want the thing. How could anyone not smell a rat? Probably it was someone returning a favor to his dad for some legal advice or for drawing up a will or helping the town council draft something. Maybe the favor came from that Mrs. Hersha lady who owned the fudge and chocolate store and was pretty connected in town, her and her husband. They were on boards and committees and stuff. And Mark's dad had helped her a couple years back when she had to change the name of her store, back when the Hershey's company got nasty with her and sent her those cease and desist or whatever letters. She had to change the store from Hersha's Chocolates to TGI Fudge, which was possibly the stupidest name he'd ever heard for a store. Like, thank God it's fudge, not a big turd. What a relief. Or there were other people he'd done some law work for, too, who might have done it as a favor. It could have been anybody or a few different people conniving. His dad was really busting his ass to get along with these hicks, so he probably had them all snowed into thinking he was this great guy and everything. And though this stupid job was probably mostly meant to cement his dad's position as one of the hicks, the way his dad presented it to him, the things he said, made Mark wonder if his dad was actually buying his own BS. Like it did honestly have something to do with the stuff Miss Guidi, his school counselor, said about him last winter. Like his dad legitimately thought it would be good for him, as crazy as that seemed. Finally, he just told his parents, fine, whatever, and left it at that. All right, that's a little overview of the fudgies, etc. I'd like to read another part of another local who's very important to the town. This is the orchard north of town. This is self-explanatory. At the main entrance to Von Buschberger's, the big fruit orchard north of town, on one side of the main driveway stands a big wooden sign, visible a half mile off by even the speeding fudgies who whip up 31 every summer weekend. The sign features scrolled black lettering, oddly old-fashioned and old world if you really examine it, on a familiar lemon-yellow background, and it reads simply, Von Buschberger's. Then, in smaller letters below, though not that much smaller, local fruits since 1907. On eye hooks below hang removable slats that outline what these local fruits currently are, nicely lettered in the same font. This information is almost just quaint trivia because the main crop is always cherries, sweets, blacks, royal Anne's, Rainiers, tarts. At times, you can also get peaches and melons and berries, and they're good enough. But what the name Von Buschberger has come to mean, what the original homesteader there, Emil von Buschberger, first envisioned planting trees by hand back in 1907, is cherries. The sign, constructed by the current head of the von Buschberger family, is surrounded by a beautifully terraced arrangement of lake rocks and pansies and geraniums and August moon hostas. Von, as he is known, his real name is Hubert, but everyone, including his wife, calls him Von, since when your last name is von Buschberger, that's more than enough. Also installed two all-weather spotlights on either side of the sign to light it at night. His wife, Carol, found this extremely aggravating and vain, since the workday was over by sunset. Just because we're not open at night, Von told her, doesn't mean we can't advertise to people driving by at night. Carol never bought this argument. Is it your hope they'll start wandering up to the porch, knocking on the door, waking us up? My hope, he said, is to just keep the von Buschberger name in their mind. Carol just saw it as an added boost to their electric bill. You want them to know we have fresh fruit that they won't be able to buy till tomorrow. They didn't always turn the lights on. Directly in front of this sign, in a smaller circle of flowers where the rock border formed a figure eight, there stood a wrought iron signpost, taller than Von. If you weren't from Winneshkin and didn't know the man behind this post, you'd probably think that something had been swiped and just never replaced. Not so. The pole was, as yet, a sign virgin. It was waiting for its sign. The von Buschberger family had been owners, operators, and residents of the orchard for nearly a century, just a hair short of qualifying for centennial farm status, which was granted by the state of Michigan to farms that had been in the hands of one family for 100 years. The tangible benefits of this were tax breaks and the moderate increase in revenue from the heightened prestige and public awareness that would be enjoyed by both their product, making it more of a name brand, and their on-site sales, making the place more of a destination, like taking the family to a museum or historical battlefield. Von wasn't sure why exactly, knowing that a pie or a lug of cherries came from a farm with an unbroken family lineage made a person want it more or made it seem more delicious, but the marketing class he'd taken at the county community college confirmed his hunch that this was so. Plus, they sent you a very official-looking roadside marker, which was just too cool in and of itself, and which was why Von already had the post. The migrants started arriving on an early June Sunday in time to help finish up with the small berry crops and then begin the real work, picking sweet cherries from the end of June till the end of July and starting the tarts mid-July or thereabouts, the apricots the last of July, then the peaches and nectarines about mid-August. They mostly arrived in crews under a work boss, and the biggest batch was Santi's bunch, the Guatemalans. Von was in front of the tractor barn, oiling and sharpening the pruning rig, when a dusty pickup, it was always a different dusty truck every year, pulled in, making a wide arc of grumbling gravel and dust, the shocks squealing. Santi waved his straw hat, grinning, and it was clear he'd had some dental work done over the winter, the taking out kind, not the putting in kind. Von judged he had at least a dozen workers with him, the driver and his daughter, Marita, up front with him in the cab, and the rest standing and squatting in the bed, though most of them looked somewhat familiar. Some were definitely new this year, squinting around at the property, getting their bearings. The dust was still clouding up around them as Santi got out, swaying toward Von with his big brown hand outstretched to shake. Behind him, the workers looked dazed and wobbly as they dropped to the ground, getting their land legs back. Von and Santi shook hands, and then Santi was back at the pickup, helping his daughter out. That's when Von caught sight of the belly. This was not a matter of too many greasy tortillas or a pork-rich diet. The girl was pregnant. Oh, no, Von said, shaking his hand in the air to help with the translation. This was no good. No, Santi, please, I can't have this. No, no, Santi said, it's not a problem. Already it was starting, the headaches of summer, and it wasn't even warm enough to put away the down duvet yet. He covered his face with his hands. It made it easier to think, to say the tough things he needed to say to this man. I know she's your daughter, I know, but we can't do this, Santi. All the workers need to work. She works, no problem. No. No, it is a problem. I'm not having a pregnant lady out in the field catching sunstroke. We don't do that here. Jesus, Santi, you're aware this is America, right? Of course this is America. This is Winneshkin, Michigan, United States of America. It's a wonderful place here. Mr. von Buschberger, the daughter stepped forward with a little sway like she was carrying firewood. He liked that she said Mr., not Senor. He remembered her now, pretty girl, the big beseeching eyes. She had always been bright and lively, a good worker, but then she'd always been someone non-pregnant before. I understand if you do not want me in the trees, but I can maybe help around the house or at the fruit stand. Is whatever you want. I help as long as I can. Vaughn put his face back in his hands. He couldn't take it. All the workers were watching now. He wondered how much of the discussion the other pickers could understand. But what did they really have to understand? Migrant picker girl, big as a house, upset white landowner. It was pretty much a silent movie, he expected. There was housework, of course, and the two roadside stands. The larger of the two had a pie oven in back, and they baked and sold fresh pies. But there was Carol for that, and his eldest, Brenda, and several local ladies who would get very territorial and huffy. They were German, for the most part. He knew that it would make him look like a tyrant, cold-hearted, because he couldn't give her some sort of meaningless make-work. But on a farm, there was really no such thing. Not if you didn't want the bank to take it all away. The only way to even make the smallest margin of profit was to not allow any waste, any deadwood or free rides or duplication. I'm sorry, Marita, he said. I can't do that. I don't have a job for you. He risked looking her in the eye now, expecting she would start tearing up and there would be a lot of weeping and dramatic Latin nuttiness all around. He'd be the bad guy, the evil gringo, and have to go hide in the house. Probably his wife, Carol, would continue to scowl at him for a few days after, refer to it as the summer you drove that poor girl off, even though even Carol would realize he didn't have any choice. But there weren't any tears from the girl, just a flare of her nostrils. She was bold, this one, tough. He wished she wasn't pregnant. He needed more non-flimsy people around him. She just raised her chin slightly, like she was about to say something he wasn't going to like. The screen door slammed behind him, and he heard dirt scuffling. Startled, thinking some emergency was at hand, Vaughn whirled to see it was just his son, Jack, laughing hard and pumping away, running straight for them. Was he actually whooping? Jesus gad, the boy was sure glad to see the pickers. Jack brushed past him and practically skidded in the dust like a runner about to slide home, cutting on the brakes in front of Marita, and then, slowly, gently, grinning, wrapped his arms around her. She threw that head of big black hair back, and they were both either laughing or crying or both. Vaughn stared as his son squeezed her very carefully, her feet lifting a few inches off the ground. It was as amazing as a magic trick. Behind them, Santi was grinning now too, displaying his brown gums, and he stepped forward and patted Jack's arm in a small area that Marita wasn't busy squeezing and kissing. It sounded like the boy was saying baby over and over, as if that wasn't readily apparent to anyone with eyes and even the loosest grip on the basic concept of human reproduction. Vaughn, who rarely swore in front of the help and certainly never in front of his own children, said, "What the fuck?" That evening, while his wife continued to hustle back and forth to the little house across the yard with dishes and armfuls of old linens, getting them settled in, making it nice for the kids, Vaughn still was trying to wrap his head around this whole thing. First of all, he had been pretty sure, as recently as breakfast, hell, even 5 minutes into the migrant worker's arrival, that his only son was gay. The boy had gone on maybe 3 or 4 dates back in high school, usually unavoidable affairs like prom and sumac days cotillion, but he never had a girlfriend, at least any that Vaughn had ever met. Certainly not a girlfriend, the kind that hooked her fingers into his belt loops and tugged him around a shopping mall. Maybe he had down in Lansing, but who knows what goes on at college. The facts, as Vaughn knew them, were the kid was 22 and he never talked about girls. He didn't hang any girly posters in his room growing up, and it just seemed whenever his great aunt Sadie referred to the boy fondly as the sensitive soul of the family, that she had pretty much nailed it on the head. Carol, on the other hand, seemed to adjust to this news in a flash. She'd been breezing around the place, humming and gathering up pillows and blankets like it was nothing more than an unexpected sleepover. Jack and a pal camping out in the treehouse. Meanwhile, the head of the family, the goddamn patriarch, didn't have a clue, because apparently this had all happened back in January. It was Jack's last year at Michigan State, and even Vaughn thought it might be reasonable to let the kid go have some fun during his winter break. He figured he'd earned it. Brenda, their oldest, had never done anything like that during her many years in college, road trips or Fort Lauderdale, but school came easier to her. Jack wasn't as much of a student, so it stood to reason that he might need to let off more steam or have more to celebrate. He told them he was flying to Monterey, Mexico with a couple of friends and that they might rent a car and drive over to Cancun on the coast. At the time, Vaughn tried not to sweat the details because He thought, on some level, these might be gay friends, and he didn't want to know about what they were up to down there with the cabana boys and the eating the worm and all that crap. Christ, you remember, now they had received a goddamn postcard saying Mexico is great and how much he was enjoying just doing nothing. The thing was still up on the refrigerator. It was all just a big fat lie. It was so crazy, he had to keep repeating it to himself just to get the order of events straight, the whole outline of it. Okay, they fell in love last summer, secretly. He snuck down there in January and decided impulsively to get married because she was Catholic and her family was so goddamn important to her, and if she was going to do it, she had to have every last relative there, down to the last wizened, immobile great-grandmothers and the family dogs. And then she got pregnant that week sometime, and he returned, and she wrote him and told him, and now she was here. For good, not just for the season. And now Jack would not be sleeping in his room downstairs, but had moved across the yard with his wife of all things. The two of them were out there right now in the little house, slipping into a bed together, the same bed he'd slept in with Carol back when they were first married. Jesus God. And then there was Carol and her part in this. It was only now, after a whole day of this, when it was time to go to bed and he was sitting there watching her reorganize the linen closet, that he finally put it together. She was folding their duvet and putting it away. Vaughn thought she was being hasty, that it wasn't warm enough yet, but he didn't care about that anymore. The fact that she hadn't troubled him to stand up and help her fold the duvet, an obvious request, since he was just sitting there on the bed doing nothing but watching, suddenly seemed like the light-stepping act of someone who felt guilty or self-conscious. The only reason she hadn't set up the little house for them ahead of time was she hadn't wanted to spill the beans. "You knew all about this," he said. "Not all about it." She turned from the linen closet to frown at him. "I knew when he got back from Guatemala. He showed me the pictures." "You mean Mexico?" "He was only in Mexico the time it takes to change planes to Guatemala. And yeah, I knew they were involved to some degree last summer. We didn't talk about any of it till after the wedding, though. I'm just the mom. When it comes to love, I'm a neutral party. I don't promote, I don't prohibit. I just listen. And by the way, it's not my job to make you two communicate. That's something you two need to work on. This was his news to tell you, not mine." Vaughn couldn't believe what he was hearing. His own wife had kept this from him. "So you knew she was pregnant?" She frowned. "She wasn't pregnant when they got married, Vaughn, if that's what's bugging you." "Right." He knew he sounded snide, but he was beyond caring. "That's what's bugging me. My only son just eloped with some migrant picker, some wetback, and what I'm concerned about is the sanctity of the marriage bed. How'd you guess?" She walked straight over to where he sat on the edge of the bed and stood over him. "That's the first time I've ever heard you use that word." He looked away. "And that's the last time you're going to use it." She hooked him under the chin, raising it with one sharp finger, getting his full-on attention, like a scolding mom about to dole out the time out. "Clear?" "Clear," he said. "I'm sorry. But I'm just not happy about this." "You can be unhappy," she said. "Just don't be an asshole." "That's a word I've never heard you use." "Hey," she said, "new things happen all the time, Vaughn. It's called life." Okay. How are we doing? I think I'm going to end on a little part from the Reverend, who's a... sort of a heartbreaking character. One of the locals. I was thinking about reading this essay, but I think I'll do this instead. Just to give you a little background, this is a flashback about when he met his wife. When we meet the Reverend, all his connections to the town have basically been severed recently. His wife just died of cancer. He's resigned as the minister. And he lives in the parsonage, so his home is also in jeopardy pretty soon, too. He's going to have to move out. So he's lost all connection to everything. But this is about an earlier time, and this is the first time we learn about him actually meeting his wife. And it takes place, this memory is taking place at a place called the Bootleggers, which is one of these old dilapidated buildings from another time that you sometimes get. I think it was partly influenced by a number of things, including the Leopold, the Loeb estate up near Charlevoix. sort of a white elephant real estate thing that's changed hands many times, and you never know who owns it. It's always in some holding company or it's changed names, but it has a bunch of different names. One is Cliff Head, and one is the Bootlegger's Place or the Gangster's Place. This was where he'd come with Mary the first time, years ago, this very beach. It was years before they moved here, before the position with First Press, before they were married, in fact. It was 1957. He was 24, still in seminary school, and attending a youth retreat at something called the Cliff Head Fellowship as a chaperone and group leader. Mary was assigned to his group, a high school junior from down in New Buffalo. She was 17. And just as he was tonight, he heard that night too, James 1:12, repeating like a stuck LP in his head, "Blessed is the man who endures temptation." Looking back, it was easy to see how it happened. They were together all day for 2 weeks. It was something that evolved slowly, that eased into being. It wasn't a tawdry, soulless thing, sudden or careless. Inevitable is how it felt afterward. They snuck away the penultimate night of the retreat, down the path of terraced flagstone that traced the stone wall, zigzagging down to the beach. They swam, he remembered, in their underwear. It was the first time he'd ever seen a woman slip outside of the Sears catalog or the painted kind on that pinup girl card deck he'd had back then. They swam out in the breakers and laughed hysterically out of nervousness and the chill, out of a fear that they shouldn't laugh, that they had to keep it down or lights would appear up on the cliff and they'd be sent home, both of them, in shame. He remembered that when they returned to shore, they were hand in hand, and it wasn't straight back to the bottom of the stairs, but veering a little to the south, to what was now a neighbor's beach with an elaborate dock and some kind of nylon windsocks like carnival flags that flapped in the dark. But back then, it was just further unmarked beach where they could move back against the grassy curve of the cliff there into the lee, both of them muttering how they needed to get out of the wind, both of them knowing full well what they were actually stepping away from. Even now, he could see the image of her afterward, standing, knees bent in the surf, one hand hoisting her soggy slip, exposing to the moonlight and to him that place he'd never seen before in his life, her other hand scooping up water, splashing the blood away. She was beaming peacefully, her head tipped, hair hanging loose to one side, watching him, watching her. He remembered how he couldn't breathe, how he sobbed, and she seemed quietly confused by that, her joy broken by concern, and waded back to shore to touch his face, and they prayed together over what had happened. The shame he felt, not for being with her, for she was beyond a doubt another part of him, some essential element that had been missing from his person, and, he hoped, he was also something that had been absent in her. But he was ashamed for letting it occur in this way, for behaving like a regular Joe, for being cheap about it. He'd once written a sermon, second year of seminary, that won that year's Witherspoon Award, and it was titled, "The Sin of Being Normal." The gist was that it's the regular Joes who blithely fall into sin, that nonconformists are better suited for leading a righteous life because they are predisposed to questioning everything, even and especially their own actions. And what better way to weigh sin, to scrutinize it, and thus avoid it? A radical thought in Joe McCarthy's Dust Cloud to champion nonconformity. It was not unlike the time he got rip-roaring drunk and later determined, that's just not me. Neither was rolling around in the sand with jail bait, rutting like two beasts more interested in soft pink tissue than brain tissue and heart. After they prayed over it, they decided they had something beautiful, but it was not to be touched again, not until marriage. And they didn't do it again, not for 2 whole years till 1959, when he was 26, graduating from seminary with a position as an enlisted chaplain on the Wurtsmith Air Force Base across the state, just above the thumb, and she was the far more acceptable age of 19. And then Ben was born soon after in 1960, Ben Webster Reacher, because they went to see him play the night they figured they'd conceived. And Abby followed in 63, and just as it looked like he was bound for a military life, which was a far more conformist life than he imagined ever falling into when he crafted that sermon about the regular Joe a decade before, an opportunity came their way that seemed heaven-sent, a sign, a way back to that special water-trapped town where they'd walked into each other's lives, that dark shore where they'd first truly been man and wife. It was 1969, a year in which the rest of the world seemed to be shuddering, but they were moving with their scant belongings back in time to that cramped, outdated parsonage where only the shelf paper ever changed. And the congregation welcomed them, gathered round them, seemed so glad to have them, excited by their youth, their newness, wanting it to touch them and bless them back. They fawned over Mary that first day, and teen girls swooped in as free babysitters, enough to handle five times the kids, taking them out into the yard, showing them the newly painted swing set and the river and the white caps on Lake Michigan beyond. There was almost a buzz as they flitted like cartoon bluebirds preparing the nest. There was an elaborate fondue with several cheeses, and everyone dug in as they darted about the house, helping unpack. They were told to keep the fondue set. It was a housewarming present. Hal Markham, who was gone now, liver cancer in 84, donated a brand new mattress right out of his store window, and the men all helped carry it in, and the women all giggled with Mary, whispered that they wanted their first night in the house to be special. The secret was, despite all that, they didn't spend the night there. After all that toting and unpacking, that whirlwind day full of new people and new sights and charging around the neighborhood, learning which dogs to pet and which to avoid, Ben and Abby were out like Lazarus. This was a safe town, they felt, where nothing would happen. And so they slipped away and spent the night back at the bootlegger's place, down on the beach, snug in the lee of the cliff, mostly talking in low, awed tones about the kind of life they were about to have and the many lives their lives would touch, and what a wonderful place this was they were about to call home. Thank you. Thanks a lot.